This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The letters were phrased when we were asked to come here. I had the impression that I had the rather delightful impression that all I was going to do was give a reading and then give a lecture. And I really didn't know I was going to, well, as everybody knows, it was a slightly different picture from that. But, as a matter of fact, then when I came, they said, oh, no, you're not going to give a lecture, but I contrived to give one because I had, when I was presented with the idea I was going to give a lecture, I had gone to our household oracle and asked them what would be the subject of the lecture. Now, while I didn't do, I've learned long ago not to say, should I give a lecture, and then the oracle say, you will die on February 13th, and then you're sunk. Instead, I always ask it like, what would you think would be sort of a, and then at the same time, I still feel sort of bounden to follow out the little plan. What the household oracle is, and that is involved in the talk I'm going to, do I have to stoop over this way? I don't think I do. Better without it. Is there anyone in the room who can't hear my bellowing voice? It would be a surprise. Somebody 5 blocks down there.
Arlene says you won't get the tape.
Oh, I see. Will the tape get me anyway, if, and I don't care about this? Okay. So, when I thought of lecturing, or even, and I didn't miss it, who it was that was going to be here, and that was all the people who already know, in some very definite sense, why they're here. I thought, what in the world do I really have at all to tell? And that is some part of my own experience in poetry. Now, in the mornings, we flung out great topics and struggled with words that none of us quite agree on, that turn all sorts of colors, but I'm going to be back in something else. Tonight, you're going to be an account of how a life grows up in poetry and how an idea of poetry forms from that. And certainly, it is not a project of what big poetry is like. It's what a life in poetry is like. Now, one of those things that's come up in that life in poetry is a thing that I call in the Pindar poem, Drawing the Sorts. In a novel by Charles Williams, but what novel, I can't remember at the moment, this was referred to. And then, lo and behold, when I was despairing of finding out where that drawing the sorts had been, I was reading Wilkie Collins' Woman in White, I think, and all of a sudden an old man draws the sorts. What he does, at every point he opens up Pilgrim's Progress and kind of goes like that, And actually, he can solve the mystery because it always tells him what to do and tells him what is up. You can do it with a dictionary. You can do it, and people used to do it with the Bible all the time. It is perhaps a symptom of the times that where and the book, you know, the book I found via a graduate student in Oriental Studies during the war who had been in Japan, or just after the war this was, in 45. And in Japan, the OWI boys had gotten wise to using a kenkusha. That is, kenkusha is a big dictionary, and in the Japanese-English section, you can't tell, as often you would with a regular dictionary, sort of know that if it began with A, you might strike such and such a word and believe it less. Besides which, the Japanese would have a symbol and then give a series of sentences showing how that symbol is used in different... Now, so since 1945 on, I have at various times used a kenkusha. This particular kenkusha, we looked 2 years before we found one that would agree to live in our house. That is, you would find a kenkusha in a bookstore, and you'd say, very politely, you'd say, would you like to come home and kind of let me use you? And the kenkusha would say, take a very long run to the nearest lake. Or you'd say, are you a truthful kenkusha? And the kenkusha really would say, are you kidding? This particular kenkusha actually was agreeable to coming home. And when I took the draw then, and I'm going to put on the board and then I will go on, what happened? Three draws that would give the shape of a lecture on poetry, and look how it hit it. Practicing the course of any lecture I've ever given on anything. Go to the office, report to the office, you get your paycheck, you've got to give the lecture. He would go to any expense in such matters. Well, cannily, I never like to interpret that as meaning money, so I interpret it as grievous experience or almost anything else. If it were money, I would make it a very small expense. I would go to just that expense that they would advance to get me there. And maybe that's what governs the other, too. And three, throw a person off his balance, upset, bewilder. And then I said, well, Kankushi, you know, you've done very well. Thank you. And have you any comments on the entirety of what you have just outlined? What do you think of your own plan for my lecture? After my thank you, which is, let's say we can put in italics, because I said thank you, Kankushi said, to prevent mistakes, to see that all is right. What certainly must have haunted me about these instructions was that one of these words, in the very first case, the word office, was a word that I got to know very well in medieval studies and then used and transferred to this idea of the poet when it was first taking form and had a very different concept of my relation to poet from the one that is predominant in my own period of the poet being the self expressing himself. That is, I was interested. Now, actually, if you look around, the poet is not only the self expressing himself, but for all people, he has also been an office, no matter where, fulfilling an office. And my word obedience has to do with fulfilling an audience. An audience is part of this picture. My word obedience has to do with this office. My word service, which is close to... And look at the ecclesiastical idea of office. Today, of course, the only office we have left, I guess, is the business office and the fact that we recognize that there are offices within the church. All right, what are the offices... And what is the office of the poet is part of what I certainly wanted to build a picture of. And in San Francisco, in one of those reaching forwards toward a higher pretension, I wrote an introduction for a reading that I gave 5 years ago, and there asked the audience not to clap after any of the readings, because I said I wanted to read as it would be in a church, performing the office. You see, when you're performing the office, you are not in a state of how good your performance is. And in that introduction, I said, yes, at the present time, we're so mixed up about performances and offices that we do clap people as if, clap for people as if they were especially gifted or talented, when actually what's at issue is one that the Catholic Church settled very early. As long as they're performing the Mass, they're performing the Mass, no matter who it is, doing that. And when a man's doing the poem, now we as poets, and even you interested in poems, yes, everybody can recognize it was a really sloppy Mass this morning, and he hasn't got it straight, and but the thing is taking place. And now this certainly brings up another one of the things I want to lead toward and perhaps give an idea how in my own life this idea came about, and that is that the poem itself is, like the Mass, a magical operation, using language as those things in the Mass are a magical operation, and close upon the numinous world, or close upon the world charged with divinity. Now, another word that certainly has haunted me that I have not used in any essay, I think. I really can't remember every point that I have or have not made clear, but this one has occupied my mind for some time, is expense. Now, actually, with my tendency in thought, I would expect an expense because it's part of the legend. Now, I've always been amazed that I have not had the expense, and that's why I really use my other word, pretend and pretension. Because I have a very high sense of what the expense is, and then since I also really believe in this office, but then I'm talking about something very different. The poet in performing in this office, that's separate, but then the other thing he is poet, and as part of the ritual that's bound in poetry, he may come to the expense. Now I'm very close to the picture we've had frequently in the morning, and that is of the self's involvement in poetry and of the transfer of heroic engagement. You see, that expense used to be what the hero had to do, and he really wasn't a poet. Poets sang of heroes, and what has happened now is that in an unheroic world, the heroic is descended. Think of all the things that have descended upon the poets. And by the way, they descended in the 19th century. Read Burckhardt when he divides all history between the soldier, the priest, and the poet. And has his complete picture of what history is going to be from this. What it means there is that the poet no longer is just telling about things, but becomes a central man of action, and no longer starts. He starts the poem and must always, as part of his office, say, "I sing of heroes," and have to do with the heroic. But now, in our time, all engagements with language are heroic because the language itself is the place where that maiden and that dragon are. There have been many places in the past, but it does seem that if there is such an engagement today, it happens in this place of the language. So just by the sense, you know, all this long time of poetry, since they've always had, that's their office. In the office now, there is this heroic drama. The next one, of course, is the picture of excess, of the heroic hubris that I also always expect. See, not just the expense, not just the expenditure of the thing, but the throw off balance, upset, bewildered. So when this session started in the morning and I arrived, and Robert Creeley and Allen Ginsberg had both already talked about throw a person off his balance, upset, bewildered, and we're presenting that, they used another term, bankruptcy. But this is what I'll stay within these Kinkusha terms. Again, I had this, how does it pitch? How did a book give these, how did a dictionary open and give these three sentences, chosen at random, by the way? You take the dictionary and the book opens and you put your finger down. And then this is where it's got to be exact. You don't move it around. You take just what it is there. And then in another place, and get the form. Well, Those are the comments and all I'm going to make about those three remarks, but they will be in back of me, as now what I want to do is to give an entirely other account, the one I can give, and that is some touches. And also I wanted especially, one of the possibilities this evening would have been to read from a book. Actually, it was an impossibility because the book is written with in such concentrated style that I myself find it difficult to follow as I'm reading it, and this would be impossible in this extension. But the other thing was, I would like to make a present to you, although this is going on a tape, I realize that this thing in front of me, I did want to do something that would give you your unique in, and also something that would draw from you. I've been drawing for 2 weeks from the questions you've asked and from actually the expressions on your faces, as I also like to write. In the few times I've ever been able to write for the stage, it was at Black Mountain, where I was able to write as the group performing in the play were acting each scene, and they were telling me, not me, they were telling me what was happening in this in the play. In a sense, I want to participate in this play from the things that have reformed this material and tell. In a different style, the story of my engagement in poetry. Now, certainly those of you who have Don Allen's anthology, what I did there in writing a little autobiography was to write the story as I saw it then of my engagement, of how this engagement came apart in poetry. One thing that seems to me, how is it that so few people, so few among all the numbers, actually become poets? My own feeling and the ones the premise in which you see all of us when we are before you, all the way from with Allen Ginsberg, myself, and this morning Denise Levertov and Robert Creeley and Charles Olson, in a very immediate sense, we have a curious premise that every one of you or any one of you would potentially be a person who is going to use us. Now, we only have one use in this sense, and that is the poem. And how did you get engaged? I wonder, how did I get engaged with this thing that I could not in any way ever, once it was there, I had no choice. Did we talk about choice this morning? And I think there was a curious, yes, Creeley had, if you could say yes and no, then it wasn't interesting, but you did not have any yes and no about this particular business. You could not say, yes, I may or may not undertake this office, because once it was there, it was there and is there. Now, in the very first engagements that I can remember at all then, and from here on I'm going to talk about poetry and see if I can keep off all those big suggestive areas, but I probably can. The very first thing I can remember back in the early 20s, was sitting with either a nurse or my mother or both at an age before I could read, when they were reading to me from a volume called Little Pictures of Japan. As a matter of fact, I have recaptured most, but not all, of the key books of my childhood. What happens is that when your parents at last heave a great sigh that you are grown up, first thing they, at least my parents did, was to throw out all those keys of childhood and hope that awful little creature didn't reoccur. But later you do find there are mysterious fairy tale books that you look and look and look, I look and look and look through children's shelves to refine. Now this volume, Little Pictures from Japan, was the product of a real educational movement in the United States that took place in the 20s, out of Chicago. And it was when I rediscovered it, this isn't always true of those little treasures. For instance, one treasure I have, one early little treasure, is the first one where that bear that haunts me frequently, when I came to confess it, if I could blush, my face should be red. It was a sickly, sweet, ghastly little book about a baby and a bear rescues, well, of course, the way I always put it was rescues the baby from his parents and takes him away in the wood and feeds him stacks of sicky, gooey honey. Actually, the book, when I have never found it again, but my memory of it is so sickening, except that there is exactly that bear which returned to me then when I was, as a real dream, totem, personal animal, and with much magic action later when I had undertaken poetry when I was 19, 20, 21. In the Japanese book, it was just classical Japanese poems, little pictures. Now let me, I was never drawn to write Japanese like poetry, as anybody who's read me knows, but little pictures were some part of it. The very beginning of poetry to me was pictures. And identified by a child's book in the beginning with sketch pictures that were very vivid when I rediscovered them, and very good translations from the Basho and the Japanese poets. I feel that outside of the very early, almost pre-reading acquaintance with poetry, there was a long, dark period. Actually, in that period, I did write poems in the second or third grade until I realized that they were pretty dreadful. I think the time I realized they were pretty dreadful, I wrote a poem to Mother about how an awful oyster has a little pearl inside him, and if you're mad at me, love me tomorrow. And I looked at something. Now this may be, we've all been nervous about how do you judge a poem. Well, this was something that almost anybody could see was not the thing. And anyway, wanting to write poetry stopped, and it only started when I saw something better than that. And that was in high school when there were the dramatic monologues of Robert Browning. Now, what I didn't know, there are school teachers here who are interested in teaching poetry. What I didn't know, and I don't know what or how or what in any way my high school teacher knew, she was a woman who was disappointed about having to teach in the middle of the Depression, having to go away when she really wanted to write. She had gone to Taos when Lawrence was still there. She had gone to Carmel because Jeffers was there, so she was a woman who probably very much wanted to be in the area of one of those charged male poets who do gather around them women admirers. Lawrence and Robinson Jeffers both are poets of this particular kind. And so perhaps as a young boy of 16 or 17, and I had quite a crush on this teacher, if you can call it no crush, I fell in love with her because every single day really was molded around the possibility of getting to that classroom and having that hour. And then I very rapidly discovered that I could also go to her house and pour out bad poetry at her by the hour, and she would look enthralled. A friend of mine, who actually is present, so I can get even in a way, reproved me for saying, all of us poets need women to listen to us. And Robert Graves is right when he talks about the muse, and when he talks about, and as a matter of fact, the interesting thing is you really don't need one. You're way ahead when you have a circle of them around looking enthralled. And yet, how did this lead? This again led to judgment of an entirely different kind. Because we've been bringing up these questions about why would your poem ever get that? Look, that woman in that high school class, I really don't know that I've ever seen anybody else look like you'd given her a present. And at the same time, she knew it wasn't so good. Years later, she said, you don't realize you were the only poet that I ever had. Now I've taught 30 years. And I was in one of the early classes. So with bad poems, those poems. Among those things that were left after my mother's death in an old box were remnants of some of that high school stuff. And I looked, there's not a, I don't know of what level. No one today writes that poorly, I'm sure, in the wide open. But they were pouring, they were really gifts, and they were taken as such. Something in here is collecting, is what I mean, and we are not yet in the presence of, yet I wanted that gift to be more and more. Certainly that was true. No one was saying, that is not the gift. Perhaps, actually, that gift always was there, and I usually put it that I was a poet who started without talent. This is not a statement that has anything to do with humbleness. It has a statement with how in the world did I ever produce out of those first effusions and gross, actually many of them were, as I remember, were masturbated fantasies that were rhymed line after line in couplets, and the iambic pentameter, when I discovered that Pounder kicked it out, I thought, hooray, because the iambic pentameter was a very suggestive thing for me. It went to tums, 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 while I poured out all sorts of adolescent vomitoria into this thing. But what, and my mother said, you don't understand about thwarted women who want to read this kind of stuff of that teacher. Actually, that remark has been also made about women who gathered around Lawrence, that they must have been a group of thwarted women who wanted to exist in the heat of his personality. Not about Frida, but I'm talking about the other, like, certainly the remark has been made of Dorothy Brett. So we're laughing about and putting, because we're in an awkward period, but we're also describing something primal in the situation of the poet, is the discovery of the female intelligence to whom this poem is going to be delivered up. And that intelligence, as for instance, the great puzzle for most people in Dante, in the Divine Comedy, is who is Beatrice? And the modern analyst is really thinks, well, Dante, he only saw her once or twice, and she was 16 when he saw her, and she married someone else anyway, and then she was dead at the time of the Cantos. This figure of the intelligence of the woman is drawn from women, and yet is drawn by a creative engagement and is recognized, drawn and recognized, or drawn in being recognized, and has to have a demand, in my own picture, has a demand, and consequently the poem is improved. Now, this, I probably just scared a whole group of school teachers who think they should be that intelligence. No, because there are many offices. And one of the offices, what is an office? You serve as a human being to stand for that thing which human beings have recognized as a noumenal person. Yes, it puzzled me enough when I started running across it in Jung, and I want to take it past Jung back to the spirit that inhabits a place or the spirit that inhabits an act. And that spirit inhabits the act in place because we call upon it. Those of you who attend the morning session will remember that at one point I asked, if we are bankrupt, which was a proposition, and all such propositions I think are alive and to be taken up, why don't we call upon the spirits that men have always called upon to, and always found ready? I think they never disappear. We disown them in order to demand that they reappear in a higher order, perhaps. I do not know, but the Newman we can always perform, and actually, as far as I have ever been engaged in poetry, although I have been I think there is a Newman of this thing. Oh, of course there is one that fascinated me in the story of Erisichthon when he cuts down the oak, If you know this Greek story, Erisichthon cuts down the oak of Demeter, and Demeter, in a fury, goes to the un-Demeter, the un-Earth Mother, who is Famine. And Famine then comes and breathes into Erisichthon in his sleep, and he can never eat enough, and he can never be fed. All the things of the earth turn into famine for him, and he I don't remember if he dies being gorged, but that this is not important. That he dies would be a release. He actually becomes, though, that figure of the self-induced, because he cut down the oak, because he attacked the earth itself, the source, and the other of that earth, the black part of it, came and breathed into him. He becomes the man obsessed with, and nothing will feed him. Everything refuses to feed him, is part of what that story says. We can, yes, perform a magic, and it's been described very early then, where we can make it so everything will refuse to feed us. But we certainly remember from childhood that we also refuse to eat, and we refused. This is one of the very major, one of my earliest memories is spitting spinach into someone's face. It may have been the muse's face. I'm sure it was another one of those more intelligent women who were in attendance. We throw up. Well, what do you do? I mean, throw in the sponge. Almost all of these things have so that this, I'm trying to make a picture here of the reciprocity. It refuses to feed you, you refuse to eat. It seems to be tied in, it seems to be the counter of attacking the source that feeds, the oak itself. Now, what I wanted to talk about this evening was work. And the attendance of the tree. What is it that we do, what is it that is our work, and what is the tree we attend? I proposed early, in the very first session when I was here, I drew a picture of a tree. I'm not going to go into great. I'm not going to try to discover where that tree started in me, as a thing I'm always going back to. But the thing we do attend, or can attack, we can chop and refuse to let it feed us, is the language, are the words. And the human experience is stored in them. Well, now, the very first poetry, if I go back to it, that I ever heard as a child, all those Japanese poems were about people living in Japan. It wasn't about. They brought me into moments in lives of grown-ups that really were mine as a child. Living in paper houses, lying in the cold. I remember one where three men are lying in the cold with the blankets pulled up and their feet. You see, these are pictures that were drawn in this book. The two things, drawing the picture and writing the picture, were... Now, no one related to me then that actually these Japanese picture poems involve puns, go on to many other levels. When I got to college then, I did not want what was in a literature course. I can remember Miss Keough saying, you are going to make... You're going to have a choice at college, and I'll be very interested to see what you take, which choice you take. You will want to study English literature, but I'm not sure that's what you will really do. What I found, of course, was that this classroom had become, in high school, had become for me the place of the Newman, and I rapidly, right away, discovered that the classroom in the university wasn't that. In the first place, they didn't have women like the Jews. I mean, they didn't have women there giving you the poem or this relation. So that ended that one, and you had something like me standing up in front and talking at you, and you knew right away you were going to have to look someplace else for that poem. Now, the first thing, very early thing that has always stayed with me then was that the poem was some kind of ritual. And in like the magazine Tisch that's put out here, when I was in college, I put out a mimeograph magazine which I called Ritual, and filled with me and a few other people I knew. And tried over and over again then to write a poem which would bring me into something else that had fascinated me from childhood, and that was the Greek legends and fairy tales of my early childhood, and some of those must have preceded my reading at all. I do know that when I was in high school, the first in the whole aura, the first aura of sexuality was entirely interpreted. I entirely interpreted it, and at one point, disastrously, into ultimate a disaster, but I did get my chin torn open with brass knuckles by such a misinterpretation. I thought it was everything seemed to change in the first floods of sexual feeling into a world I had read about when I was a child, which was the world of dryads and nymphs, of satyrs, of Pan, of woodlands. I wandered in high school through, I would wander whenever I was out of school, and often when I was supposed to be in school, along deserted riverbanks out from Bakersfield. And the fantasies, actually now I am at the place now in this book that I'm working on HD, one of the things I have to do is to recapture those fantasies. I've been able to deal very well with early childhood fantasies, but to recapture what it was like when, and now I'm trying to tell you that at least for, because often people ask, well, why do you have Apollo in that poem? Why do you have Mercury? Why do you have all those, that Greek stuff? I wandered in it in a time when it was not a matter of education, it was a matter of the fairy tale world of my childhood, which had been transformed into an adolescent world, and I did not know what now I know in reverse, that these very stories and legends were a secret of sexuality. So that trees, everything, I had no picture of what, I grew up in a very different period, and I had no picture of what a sexual act would be. The most reference would ever be made to my sexual organs would be my aunt just saying, now you know you never take all your clothes off at the same time. You take your shirt off and you put the top of your pajamas on, and then you, can't remember how, I think I must have had very long tops of pajamas. How did you take your trousers off? However it went, you really kept this secret that was going to come out of its egg sometime. You kept it beautifully in a shell, and so that that shell being is very much like the Greek world. They had initiation. When I said, when I wrote in 1952, a whole string, I was never baptized, I was never psychoanalyzed, I was never graduated, I meant graduated from college in any sense, and I was never initiated, and that stood in my mind for a very definite, I will describe that this evening, although boy, you talk in that little hand goes around so fast that I don't know, but I will describe the business about the struggle not to be initiated. Actually, of course, you get fooled. We do have initiation points, and all of us have them. Except that the whole tribe has a very secretive way about going about it. But all of our transitions in life that we make are initiations. Going to college is an initiation, and there are initiations when you come into the family organization from childhood. And one of these initiations that was certainly forced was the initiation of moving into the sexually charged landscape. Charged and turned into a dream because I had no concrete terms nor even knowing what it would be for what a sexual act would be. So very definitely didn't have them, and in other words would be almost in the position that they found some primitive tribes where they have no words for acts they perform, that I did not consciously know that I masturbated at all until I went to college. And yet, you certainly realize when you refer back what Freud calls, screen images must be just disappearing. People now, you know, little kiddies are romping around with use of ideas. I don't mean that they know, but they are already in the ideas I was never in. except in this. Now some of you will begin to realize when I talk about those boundaries way out there, how early I must have had them, and had them certainly then in high school. An excitement you didn't know how to locate, things you began to hear and realize that people were doing and then couldn't even figure out, well, what does that mean? And yet, also in the same time, what is the cost of this? Everything was eroticized. I've never left that. And nothing was as simple as it could have been. In the very period when I was going through this, earnest and rational people were wanting to make sexuality simple, natural, clean was one of their terms, and take away its sacred taboo character. And I am certainly a remnant in one sense, in that I grew up in and consequently am thoroughly of the sacred and taboo. I understand what Lawrence says when he says, do not touch me, because touch is charged and not familiar for me. I mean, for me as an animal growing up in this thing. How much one... But because nobody was, in a sense, they were only closing it off, that whole world charged with the Greek gods was a world of do not touch me. It was overcharged whenever it was there. When I left college then, when I was a sophomore, I went back in a period much later when I was in my 30s to study history, because then I actually was going back for an education. I can make the remark that most people do not go to a college for an education. They go there for the degree and the consequent job and career that lies ahead of it. So it's very rare in our time that anybody goes to college for an education. I mean, to find something. And it's very difficult, by the way, to go to a university and ask for an education. I had a very difficult time because I was not going to be an historian, but because there was a great historian, I wanted to study with him. This is almost impossible to explain to a university, that you want to study with a particular man because he is brilliant and because you're fascinated by history, but you do not want to be an historian. They feel about as if you went to apply to a bank and said, I like banks because I want to take money home. They try to patiently to explain to you that's not what we're doing. And I know we've got lots of money here, but you get to handle it. And later you may get some of it when you learn how you do it kosher. But well, this is anticipated way ahead. What did I do then? I left San Francisco and Berkeley, where I lived. Oddly enough, I had a scholarship to Black Mountain College. I won't tell that whole story. It's not illuminating in relation to writing, but it is in relation to this sacred Black Mountain College. I had a scholarship, and it was canceled the day after I arrived, and was found emotionally insecure or unstable. And so there I was afloat with launched all my allowance in getting there, and I had a full scholarship. I hadn't planned. Just recently, I was trying to figure out how was I broke at this time, because I did have an allowance until I was 21. It must have been a legal affair, because my mother wanted to cut it off the minute I decided not to be an architect, as my father was, and decided that I was going to be a poet. She ran down the whole list of the arts. You could be a painter, and that would be all right. But poets write about things like you were having with your teacher, and this would be disgraceful, was a picture even then. Now I think what I'll swing back to before I get to this, or before I get to this point, to swing back from where I'm on the loose there, because I had already a direction in poetry in a series of finds. And I've described them in the HD book, and I can summarize them for you, because I found them to be real little openings into the world. How soon I came into the world that remains for me now the center, the masters for my own sense of the poem. One of the poems that on a hot summer day Miss Keogh read to us was the poem Heat by HD. She gave me, she fed me as far as I would read. She gave me The Man Who Died by D.H. Lawrence. She gave me as a kind of challenge to see what, and she would always give these and say, I want to see what you'll make of it. Or when she gave me The Man Who Died Said, she said, you will not understand this now. Don't talk, don't try, read it, but don't talk to me about it. In other words, I give this to you and sometime later you will begin to. And my sense was, when I turned back to that, that what she meant was you'll begin to grow through this. Now, she was giving me a series of things I actually did grow through, and to me they they belonged to something she also must have recognized in me, this very thing I'm talking about. Certainly Lawrence was a key person who had the same highly erotic, no, do not touch me, that was torturing me. I wanted to be like everybody is told in America, to be friendly with everybody and get along with everybody, but I certainly had this charged sense of oneness or one personness, or and then the great other possibility, which was the orgiastic orgy. The two things. Greek really couldn't fill in between the pictures. They tried to fill it in with an elite, but I don't think that's an adequate. I have never found an elite and a adequate picture for myself, even when I wanted to hold it. Calvinist elite or the sensitive elite I always was really too much a misfit, and any elites I ever met certainly didn't like me. I would have met, if I'd met an elite who would have included me, I would have been very happy, I guess, and had a different view. So being rejected by an elite must be part of this picture. Now, when I got to college, I did come close to what I thought was an elite, and it has some humorous cast, because certainly it was only the kind of... I was overawed when I was on the freshman staff of the literary magazine. This is a place where I really wonder how many poets can ever survive being on the freshman staff of a literary magazine. Well, I did. There was a magazine, a poem that came in by Louise Antoinette Krauss. Everybody rejected it except me, and I asked if I could return the poem. Now, at this point, my whole view of poetry was still at that high school level. I did not know that there was a thing called modern writing and the right way, and at this point I was shown the right way as follows. I sent some poems to this Louise Antoinette Krauss, and then she asked me to meet her and her consort, Robert Haas, who had a Stein collection. It was there I first saw Stein, heard about James Joyce. But I still remember Louise Antoinette Krauss. I was pattering after them along like this. He said, should he read Eliot? And she said, no, his work is already too lurid. He should read Pound. Which was really the very highest taste, and I have never been able to include Eliot on any list in good conscience since. I've drawn over and over and over again the list of people who'd be my masters, and actually my work was rather luridly wanting to snatch little things from T.S. Eliot, but when I'd make the list, I could never get him on the list. And of course, later I'd find that this was very sound, but I suspect my own reasons, because I can still hear the voice saying, no, his work is already too lurid, Ezra Pound. So I went to a bookstore. There was no Ezra Pound on reading lists in 20th century literature in those days. None at all. I mean, he was about as prevalent. Well, actually, today you can find Charles Olson on reading lists at the University of California. I nearly stared and fell down when I saw that. But in my day, you couldn't find Ezra Pound on the reading list. And so I'd had the right word and discovered that nobody knew anything about it. That gives you a great kick. To discover nobody knows about it in your English class and you've got the right poet. So I went to a bookstore and I opened it, and then I saw that line and went down to the ships. I thought, oh, how could anything be that good? I mean, how in the world? And shut the book as if I had peeked at something. And it took me 3 visits to that store to read that first line again and again before. And I bought the book and then still felt this is too much for me to... What's going to happen to me if I read this poem? Actually, I was with the cantos, and those first 30 cantos, the rest of my life. So, although even that rest of the... wait a minute, since tonight I'm trying to give a picture The 30 cantos became a book of the past. Yes, they certainly did. They became a book of the past in the sense that I had a feeling of being so at home with them that they no longer presented the challenge, just at the point when the Pisan cantos presented a new challenge of something really new happening in Pound's work. But Pound has always remained a central master for me. So I had a concept of masters. Let's think of these layers again. I had the very first concept, which was this childhood one, just of pictures and just of a world you go into. We talked this morning a little about the other world. Now, that was not unmixed with another source, which were fairy tales and Greek legends, which made very clear that there was some other world, and that other world I felt very much around me. Now, I cannot remember in childhood that I felt that other world very much around me. It was just in books, I think. I think that I only felt the first descent of this otherworldly quality around me. My picture's very hazy of a childhood in my adolescence. And then certainly I did. I'm not hazy at all. I actually felt deranged. I knew very well that my picture of the world was exceedingly different from the picture. And often in the period of... thank goodness I wasn't shacking up with Hans Christian Andersen that year, or I would have, you know, just ended up the ugly duckling. And not the swan I was to be. The feeling of being, if anybody knew, except this teacher. Now, what is such a permission? This is another word I use. You can just look at those things in the back. I'm not worrying about whether I get there. But this word, when I began to think of that word, it was long after the poem in which it occurs. And I was in New York at a point, and Ned O'Gorman had given a talk or something on my poems, and he showed me the notes he had, and he had permission. And I said, how did you know about that? And he said, well, that's in the first poem in the opening of the field. I said, it is? I had thought that this was one of those words that I had not dared to even tell about. It had increased and increased and increased about where did I have a permission. And yet, when I look back at it, there was 3-4 years before there had been, and I'll read this opening poem in the field. And actually, in this, I think, in a way, I prepared for you to see something of, you will see that high school teacher, if you want to think of her in here. Often I am permitted to return to a meadow, as if it were a scene made up by the mind, that is not mine, but is a made place, that is mine, it is so near to the heart, an eternal pasture folded in all thought, so that there is a hall therein that is a made place, created by light, wherefrom the shadows that are forms fall. Wherefrom fall all architectures I am, I say are likenesses of the first beloved, whose flowers are flames lit to the lady. She it is, queen under the hill, whose hosts are a disturbance of words within words, that is a field folded. It is only a dream of the grass blowing east against the source of the sun in an hour before the sun's going down, whose secret we see in a children's game of ring a round of roses told. Often I am permitted to return to a meadow as if it were a given property of the mind that certain bounds hold against chaos, that is a place of first permission, everlasting omen of what is. I see something else in this poem now, if I were to think now of what I'm trying to do this evening, give you a picture of some of the sources that an individual life has that feed the poet and the later feeling of the ultimate reality in the poem. And I also can clear up now, because the poems helped me to see another thing, why I said and in what way it was true that my childhood did not, in a way, have access to, a clear access to this noumenal quality that descended in adolescence so clearly with the sexuality of adolescence. This dream of grass blowing east against the sun and the children dancing in a ring is a obsessive dream I had as a child. It was terrifying, actually, because in the dream, it was a regular London Bridges fall down, or also selecting a person to be out or in. A king was selected in the middle of the ring. Then I was the king. Then the hubris had been the going too far, the throwing the person off his balance, the involved expense had been performed, both by the children in the ring and I of the children in the ring, in selecting me as king, and in myself, because I knew I was the dreamer, in making myself a king, and this whole thing changed, and it was a subterranean cave where there was a throne, an empty throne, but then I would also often, because this dream came over and over again, I would often try to reassert being the king and being in the throne, which is impossible. Great doors broke open and the cave was flooded with water. Now, what this dream, we can, Freudians could interpret it as a birth trauma dream with a flood of waters, especially since my mother died in childbirth. There may have been, I haven't read Otto Rank, but he's the one who thought up that idea. My family were theosophists, thought of it as an Atlantis dream. One of the things that closed me off from the numinous world was, while my family did not permit any ideas about sex to be expressed, consequently, when I came to my sexual adolescence, I came into the numinal world, they had far-reaching ideas about what childhood meant, and I was and they included childhood fantasy. So that this dream was explained to me. I wonder what's happening to children whose parents are Freudians, who understand their dreams consequently and understand what they're doing. Because certainly one of the things that must happen is that the creative life then is profoundly disturbed. We're disturbing the creative life when we tell somebody else. I mean, it takes a great deal of strength to be told what you're doing. In fairy tales, or in any heroic adventure, one of the keys is not to be told what you're doing. And yet, we want to risk it all the time. I have not faced any younger poet where I do not want to tell him the secret of what he's doing in his work. Now, this is maybe I'm also getting at what I meant by this other thing, the woman's intelligence. The woman's intelligence has a way of provoking the adventure, almost smiling as if you know you're doing it very well, and I've really seen this much, isn't there some more? I mean, and not telling you what that is. I mean, this is one of the things, certainly the master, the teacher, always wants to tell you. And perhaps we have to learn not to do this. Actually, of course, all of us are short of the one. The master in the fairy tale does not tell you. He only gives you a few of those ununderstandable things you are to remember, and he never gives you more than three. He gives you three, and you've got to know when to use them, which is the other part of this thing. He doesn't tell you the whole thing that's there. Well, my childhood, really, every fantasy I had in childhood was known and was understood by my parents. As, for instance, at the present time, all fantasies in all childhood world are understood in Freudian terms. These were understood as in terms of reincarnation. And a good deal of my initiative sought, perhaps, other areas where they wouldn't be interested, but they were interested in almost anything. If I drew a picture, it was a picture of Atlantis. My horoscope had said that in their belief, it was very, very dark horoscope. And I belonged to the last generation that had been in Atlantis when it was destroyed, and my parents believed that our total civilization was going to be destroyed in a cataclysm. I actually found the papers from the early 20s just after the First World War, that would haunt us now, certainly, because we are in the presence of some of this, of something realized in this dimension, that our technique would go on, our technique of war would go on until we would destroy ourselves. This was the urgency of our time. By the way, that statement can be found in non-theosophical circles. Henry Adams writes Home from Japan in the 90s, if we keep going on this present direction in physics, we'll blow the universe up by 1940 or something, he says. There are many other statements that now ring out fit into the picture that people in different ways made in the turn of the century. Well, one of the things then was certainly what I think of as formative things being kept secret. And at the same time, you find that only the necessary, my other statement was only the necessary should be kept secret. I mean, and certainly I didn't want, after I finally find out and enter sexuality, I no longer am that interested in it being kept secret. I think our release now, sexuality, so that it's no longer magical. I wonder how it could possibly be magical for the new generation to see it as a simple physical contact in reality. It can have depth. I'm not talking about it's not having depth, but this noumenal quality, that is the place something's going to happen, must be removed. It must be a demand that it happens someplace else. And I'm giving a picture also then of how one can. Yet I'm from the beginning, as I've said, I've always, in a sense, not belonged. My experience has then been somehow always there. Coming, imagine, you see, in a period when, with parents who don't talk about sex at all, it's noumenal. Then I come into a period where everybody talks about it, and my noumenal reality is just as strange as it ever was. So my picture that I sort of go on in this is does hold in a way. Now, I did say I was going to describe what I meant when I said I was never initiated. From this, I'm sure, from some of the, I recognize many ambitions from the hold I would have on my parents, from this period, from this picture that they had, that I had actually been something before I was a child, so that I could use this at any time. And actually, my parents from the horoscope thought I had, that I was inflicted on them, and that I was something considerably more than they were. And they in no way bothered to dissemble this. In case you want to know, I don't know. Everybody was talking about egos. I have never been troubled with. I mean, it just was sort of there because every time you wanted to turn that trick, you could make a sly allusion to Atlantis, and they could sit around like this. And so actually all of this thing actually became not quite true for me. It had been used so many times. At times it's been in poems, but I really can't, like Hart Crane, get with that Atlantis thing, because there was a bit of a con job when I was little to remove that possibility. And I can't, in time, some of it gathers back. Now, one of the places where I wanted to gather it back, because I did have then, even in childhood, something that coincided with what was there in fairy tales, and that was the idea of having magic power, or of being a power. I'm surprised how much, and you must have reflected, how much what we say in that morning session, when we're talking about consciousness or something else, has to do with the aura of personal power. To move as, I don't mean to have a power over something, but to move as a power and to know yourself as a power moving, to know yourself as a power in the language, to know yourself as a power among people. Now, this, by the way, about the power of a number. I mean, what are you when you represent the power of something? I mean, when you are a power, You see, the whole suggestion is that you're dwelling in and you're inhabiting a field that you belong to, and consequently, at least this is, now I'm giving you my picture, and part of the picture that I was drawing on when I began to use a word that came from Charles Olson, this, from his projective verse, field, and then by my hunting and driving, even by pun, by any possible means to increase the operation of a word, it came to mean a field. It came also by reading everywhere about that field to mean the Roman field, and then the field, and also the field at Machpelah, where Abraham saw the Adam and knew that this was the center of the world, and the field of power. All of these things are they're terms borrowed from sciences, they're terms borrowed from all around, and transform the world into something very much like the world that was in fairy tales and myths, because it has an absolute requirement of you. Now, then you rediscover freedom in terms of this power. To be a power is to have bounds, and you rediscover yourself through and a freedom in the terms of the things you draw on and then fulfill. As, for instance, the only heroic thing, if we think about that, human attraction to to be a hero, or let's say to reach the glory, all we have to do is think of the drama of Oedipus, in which he does not come to the place where he tears out his eyes. Something about the figure. Now this more and more, by the way, and now I'm jumping way ahead, but then I am not jumping ahead of what I designed here. When I said, I feel I have not borne the expense, and then I'm not sure of what this is, although I believe in it. I believe in it because I do believe in I believe in it like I believe in the end of a poem that I haven't reached yet. Because of design. Design gives you this. And actually, design can give you the imperative that you ought to be, you know, that I must, that this story requires. My sense of story requires that it be bankrupt. I don't know how I am bankrupt, but the story says now I am, if I could put it that way. What happens in a fairy tale, the first ones you listen to, you go along, and if you're with it and paying attention to the three things that were said, you have to interpret anything that comes along as being yourself off balance. I mean, you have to interpret the right thing, but it has to be, you have to recognize it when it comes. Recognizing being off balance, recognizing spent, finally release the thing you secretly were. Then when, you see, I'm actually trying to share with you things that I imagine must be very puzzling and also must make for an individual. How many, well, let's say, how many people in the room had parents who were theosophists? One. I mean, how many, any others? Well, this is sort of an isolated sort and yet I'm describing, and yet many of you must have had, of course. Then I could also ask how many of you had parents who never mentioned sex and who really contrived a childhood in which you, when you came to the matter of sex, it was your matter, not a social matter. Well, that's a little more familiar. So it doesn't just take being, as a matter of fact, of course, the theosophists aren't notorious, and my parents were a combination of several things, and they seem to have had a certain common ground. So when people wonder, can I read a poem and you understand it, all those others can understand another area. But I'm fascinated by the, what gathers with the, because I'm trying to locate where do these areas that this thing I call a noumenal, a sense of or a sense of power of it being all your own, where do they originate? See, what if there'd been something would have been more despoiled, it seems to me, if my parents had been like myself, where I would might very well want to have the child be imaginative. My imagination was left free because my parents, that was helped by the fact that my parents had all those fancy interpretations for everything. I keep wondering what will happen with the parents who sat in on those creative, all that creative painting and those creative poems with the child. I don't think mommy and daddy are the muse. I mean, I really think that's another round. This may very well be because since, well, certainly my mother wasn't amused. She was not amused, as it would go. Now, but to come back to my, because I'm even resisting discussing it, my resisting the point of initiation. Since in my adolescence, the first poet I met at all, it was, and I heard, outside, of course, of myself, I had a wonderful perspective. There was just one poet moving on, Robert Duncan, and he was perfectly capable of waking up. There were several girls who were rather bewildered because he was perfectly capable of rushing over their rooms at college and waking them at 3 a.m. There are quite a few college girls who have other ideas of what you're waking them at 3 a.m. for, and reading them a poem until dawn. Well, of course, they were very appreciative, but it has occurred to me at times that they must have been somewhat puzzled. No, not entirely. But the first poet I met that suddenly made it clear there were some of those, you know, some other poets, was Sanders Russell. Now, actually, Sanders Russell was more interested in metaphysics and the same sort of things my parents had been than he was in poetry, so that in the course of his life, Alan, Sanders Russell was interested in yoga and in entering a spiritual world and being as at one point Alan said early that he wanted to be a guru or wanted to be illuminated. Sanders Russell was in the time that I knew him, I came clear with myself that I did not want to be illuminated. It was fascinating, but. Actually, there was no. I felt vaguely as if it was just like, am I not wanting to be a graduate student, or am I not? I mean, not enough, you know, to get that AB, and not wanting to be a Christian enough to be baptized. And that was at Sunday school at a crucial point. There were points of decision when I really didn't. I suddenly said, no, that you don't have a. You don't have any picture of that or what, I don't know. But what I did want, that wasn't the challenge, there was no question about that was just very clear to me, I didn't want to be illuminated and that I didn't want to improve my spiritual being. I didn't want to improve myself was certainly always very clear. And then there's something stubborn in me doesn't like that, all that onward and upward, first, this year a saint, next year an angel. But I was attracted by something that Sanders started to tell him because I had never had sex with a woman. In my adolescence, I had been homosexual. And he told me early then, you could be a shaman. So when I was 17 or 18, the idea of shaman really seen, and it was mixed up with being a poem. I mean, I had already begun to know maybe the shaman connect back from the poetry that I had. Is there a route from Ezra Pound via shaman back to that world that I talked about, the walking in the river valley? In the tule fogs of winter is what I'm remembering now. A world that was, or then it changes. It's 2 years or so of these long walks and fantasies, and as if that were a scene where nothing happened and something was always happening or about to happen. Was that the root factor? Did those two come together? So in Woodstock, I really made some effort to find out if I could enact a shaman. Oh, it included sitting naked all night in the late autumn when it was cold on a rock and trying to listen and see if I really could talk to trees. It included trying to overcome my fear of snakes. I have a picture of because I saw one in the children's zoo, so it should be a little charming image of a great, there they had a great coil of snakes, it's like a Medusa head of hair, and on those rocks. How near could you get to the snakes? Could you know? I could not plunge my hand into the... all of these things came out in some way, and not, I will at least do myself the justice, not grotesquely, because I, for one thing, I was alone. They weren't really for somebody else, but I was trying to force my way through a place where there was no door. There was no door sitting on the rock listening to talk. Although I have a very close feeling about the reality and livingness, and many other times we had seances. This is a different area of the shamanistic activity, and so I surrendered. And actually, though, I decided no, I can't. I do not really want to live this way. I do not want to live, because my picture of Shama was an isolated person, and then you saw me this morning, for instance. I was really, when you saw me, in a sense, using Allen Ginsberg as a negation, a thing I was going to negate, it goes back very strongly to a negation that I made then at 18 or 19 of the possibility of being a shaman. Well, it must have been even later, because really, but in 20 or 21, I was still still at times trying magical practices. Well, let's not worry about what it is. Let's see what I was trying to be. So that's more to the point, what I was trying to be then, how I saw this. In some tribes, the shaman is a homosexual, and the logic in back of it, and that was what I was told when I was 18, was that I found it even Lawrence, by the way, if you did not touch a woman, you were completely male, and then when you touched a woman, you had given your, now think of why I couldn't become a shaman because. In the first place, there must be, I think, a contradiction between the shaman and this poet muse. Thing that begins. My key was certainly not in this direction, but this was strong, since I was interested in power and shamans have magical power. Now, one thing shamans are, the most important thing shamans do is that they're able to go in the other world by dancing, and the figure of dancing's always had a hold in my poetry, very strong one, not derived from the idea of shaman, but derived from the fact that in a dance, you forget yourself, you enter the dance entirely. And in the high performances, and yet this dance I'm describing is folk dancing, our own Western folk dancing, not anything more elaborate, but at that elaborate, by the way, because it's really, as I remember, quite a strenuous business. We used to go a whole hour without a break, and as fast as you could go, and hope and see how many would fall out was one of the performance things of it. But you're so completely in it that it's very much like the poem for me. I mean, what I remember of dancing in the Catskills in a later period, which would be 42, 43, 44, is very much like the poem became for me when I finally was able to dance in the poem itself. Now, certainly, shamanistic things reappear in the poem. The poem became an agency for me to... move into an other world, or to talk to the dead. But I'm trying to draw to you also a picture for those of you who look at my poems that the dead really are the dead, and that in everything I had as a preparation for life, I believe in the presence and power of the dead. Certainly, I will rationalize now, so I'll show you what happens when I rationalize on this subject of where the dead are. Because for me, since what was the language, wasn't it? I mean, what are all those forces and voices that can speak through it? And if the language is charged with all the meanings that men have put into it, then those men are still there, and then the dead are still there, too. So the language has ghosts. Oh, let's just go back to, let's take Robert Browning. There will be ghosts of Robert Browning. I mean, he's one of the dead. This is one of the places we see the dead right away. And then the dead can be living. In a recent recording session with a group of Vancouver poets, two of them had, I think, been in a course where they were studying T.S. Eliot, and they had time past, time present come in, and a ghost of T.S. Eliot had come across the poem. A derivation is some kind of trafficking with the dead, and a poem is it doesn't make any difference that T.S. Eliot's alive. The moment of the four quartets is one of those things from the land of the dead. So that I've got another picture, and that is the poem when it is completed enters and haunts us. The poem when it's completed, and the ones that we keep by us do have a role in which they are the dead. And so when I read a poem like the one that we were discussing this morning of Charles Olson's and the pot and the Carries and those dead spirits in there, that includes for me one of those expenses, off balances, and bewildering things of the poem, that it is a mixture of the life and the dead. There's another poem of Olson's that directly starts with the dead and then brings up a figure of nets and talks about the untying of the nets and the tying of the nets. And that, to me, seemed, again, also to include, and has seemed in recent years, to include part of what would be the reality of the dead. But these dead I talk about, by the way, in my childhood, I heard speaking through people's mouths at seances and had my, now back to what my parents or grandparents and the people who were around when I was a little child would meet over a fireplace or around the table and call up and speak with the voices of the dead. I would be in the other room, and what I would hear would be the changes in tone of the voice, and especially attractive when you're a child or strange would be that that one of those voices that's most prevalent is to speak in a baby voice. They would have Indian chiefs, and they would have baby. They would have other child voices coming out of the adults around you talk about the dead, and so that this dimension is now where would it? I'm trying to think now. When you come to a poem like the Pindar poem, things like this, the whole variety in a way. In a long poem like that, begins to come and where, for instance, I'm writing so rapidly that I can only call upon what I have known to enter in and compose the poem. Things like that begin to come in and inform the poem right away. This football, by the way, in part four of a page, I was requested to give where a poem is if I'm reading from it. This is page 67 and part four of the Venice poem. This actually is from that period I was describing of attempt at shamanistic practices. Listening to snowfall, we also watch snow scenes, trying to see in them what we thought the snow was going to, what we call a show, because there's a screen of the falling snow in which you can see things as you can see them in the fire or in clouds. We also would lie later in western Massachusetts, lie out on a cellar door, I remember, and watch the clouds all one night, But by this time, this is sort of a game of fantasy where you watch the clouds with their changing faces and changing forms. Now this is, at night, hearing the footfall here is the snow dropping from the eaves around the house. But so intensely were we living in this, I see what I'm a little amused at what I'm doing. I was doing a lot of agreeing with Denise Levertov, but I'm describing a period of self-induced hypersensitivity, which returns much later in some actual thing. Because this, bless the footfall where step by step the boundary walker in Maverick Road, the snow, thud by thud from the roof, circling the house, another tread. At the time we followed that snow tread around and spread our superstition and about what that snow tread might be, and lay in savoring the pure fear of thud 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 around the house. Nothing could have been then or even in this return more self-induced. I think of all of, again, in rejoinder to my assent this morning that it shouldn't be self-induced, how much self-induced terror was important in my own childhood. Now, that was a territory, actually, that I found was very, very exciting and frequently indulged in. And when I described the pattern of my poem in an earlier session that we've had and drew it on the board, I said that at a crucial point in the poem there was a terror that happened. The prejudice perhaps against the self-induced is a prejudice against this shamanistic or magic operational area that the poet is in. I mean, that the poet is always near. Now, how is the poet near that actually this is the shaman and the poet at the present time, like the hero has come to be inherited by the poet, and the shaman has too. If we think of the primary, I usually get the picture now of the poet as being three primary entities that have merged into one. One from the Roman Greek world, which is poein, which is to make the poem, and is the art, the artisan, the craft, and the art. But the second is a very definite one from the Bible, from the Jewish source, which is to speak with God's voice or with God voices, and so intense was the Jewish sense against the art that Buber quotes a Hasidic interpretation of the commandment not to make a graven image, that it meant specifically that you were not to make a poem, that your poetic impulse was to speak forth without making a poem out of it, and without carving it, a great deal of activity is between these two ideas as they wind down in the thread, with a third one from the and that is the Celtic bardic poet who, and here I'm going on what we think the bardic poet is, because there's nothing that's more way out there on the borderline than this picture of the bard. The bard then is the one where we verge upon the shaman world. Actually, we find all three of these go back to the figure of the shaman, of the man who has to do with the dead, and of the man who can translate himself into an other world. And actually, our requirement of the poem that we have now that's paramount, that we see into this world where we are and see its underlying meaning, is to see the other world in the world that we are in. The same requirement that used to be to go out there to heaven or to go out under there to the underground in many, many levels now has been to see into things or to see the underlying meaning of things. The techniques of the poem. I myself, in writing a thing like the Pindar poem, while it's in the language, find the poem for me illuminates because I relate it to the life I live, and illuminates because I relate it to the things I concretely know in the world. And I take it that in writing it, this is what I'm in search with and for and dealing with. And part of what this says when I hear, oh yes, bless the footfall where step by step the boundary walker in maverick road the snow thud by thud from the roof circling the house another tread, where it inherits from the cupidinous death that will not take no for an answer and is the thing we fantasied or induced that thud of the snow was ominous with death, moves forward to the thing the foot certainly was when it came into the poem, that foot informed by the weight of all things that can be elusive, no more than a nearness to the mind of a single image. Because by the time of this poem, that snowfall has given me the foot that's in the poem. And death has given me the clothes that's in the poem. The no, the yes, look, cupidinous death will not take no for an answer, but the no there is the thing that gives me the oh yes, bless, gives it to me. And the death there via this footfall, all of a sudden it says, those feet that fall through your poem are death's feet as they once fell from the snow, where you were not making, I mean the feet you heard and the rhythm that you took into yourself at that time. Self, but nothing could have been more, well, self-induced, and even a game, of course. These things are very much like games when you're in them. Oh, yes, this, most dear, and this word was used this morning, the catalyst force that renders clear the days of a life from the surrounding medium. Listen, can I take another half hour to try to arrive at it? Because I had a vague commandment in my mind that I wanted. I wanted to give you some of these pictures of what it is and draw upon some of these points in my life, but at the same time, I specifically am working with no more than this, and at the same time, I wanted to entitle, you see the sweat's coming off my brow because I wanted to talk about work. And yet, I really could only tell you so much about how one became engaged in it, and some moments, because actually the work is not defined in my mind. I'm engaged in defining it. That's certainly something I can say. And as Denise Levertov this morning said, she thinks she lived to be 100. She has a picture of what you would do in these years, all my long life, and that's a quote at the end of Gertrude Stein's with that, all my long life I will be engaged in defining and discovering the work, and I will not believe that I can do otherwise, because when you come to read about the work, and let's take it just now as it appeared in the alchemical sense where it's spoken of as the work, when you come to read of the work, no man has ever been anything other than engaged in defining it. And so we participate in it in order for it to be. And our own work defines its area. I mean, lets it be in our life and defines something of what that work is. Now, but I said our, and I began this thing by saying one of the most puzzling things is how few seem to... For all of the fact that everybody is involved with this picture of work, or else they reach bankruptcy and despair, or the alternative, yes, the famine of it, to cut at the work, and cut, throw, put this away, and it does have another face, which is the futility, isn't this thing? And a very real one. I'm not calling this real or more real than this thing. And as far as I can tell, when we talk about person off his balance, upset, bewildered, these two seem to look like, now we can draw, like, I don't know what that means, you know, like that. Engage in this and you'll come to this. And engage in this, and I mean, they really are reciprocal. So that just at the point, because I don't think of futility as emptiness, but the alternate, some kind of alternating thing, the alternative that appears, we have had, I think, though, a picture when we were talking about bankruptcy as if it were more real. And also as if it didn't involve thoroughly in the work, and as if you didn't have to do the work in order to even find out what it means remotely. As you had to be in the work. Now I do have an example then where I can go back to something I experienced. I was in a drug experience with mescaline, and what happened in the mescaline experience, what I saw was that tree that I am frequently referring to. Now that tree was intricately made up and related certainly to those to the Muslim rugs that I have found terrifically exciting. But the picture I had always followed the Muslim rugs is that they were made often. They took a whole man's lifetime, and he tied little knot by little knot, and then the whole thing came into being, and it was a great, great design made up of little concrete acts, so that all the lifetime of that incredible rug, he was involved in it and participating in it. I saw directly before me such a tree that was only understandable to me and only acceptable if it had involved the labor. I did not participate in it. I saw it. It was a pure presentation and ununderstandable, yet as far as here again we come to our modern rationale. My first thought was, oh, you know, Plato's archetype. You've seen what he says, like you see in the cave you saw. But I am really very much in this sense a product of our time. That idea was canceled, and I said it came from me. It was me. It was an archetype of my unconscious, and immediately it was ununderstandable. I saw again what about this initiation, and I can explain something about the rejection you saw this morning of what would happen. You know, what would I take the gate that would be open to see the tree? No, because I want actually to be engaged in making the tree I do not know of. That somehow is related, by the way, I'm sure, to the one I saw. That I saw and knew was intricately, was made up of all lives, and I am a life, not such a, I would not make the leap, would not make the, it was unsatisfying. I burst into tears and rejected it, opened my eyes, so it was no longer there.